beginners. They couldn't stand the possibility of singing a sour note in public. It would be a mortal injury to their pride. The performance had to be perfect. They were not perfect. It couldn't be. So they were in trouble from the beginning. So self-consciousness in this case was just pride, just the unwillingness to face the fact that they were only beginners and would have to make mistakes. Another common cause of this type of attitude, of course, also, is the desperate desire to excel quickly or to improve as rapidly as possible. This has resulted in a general decline in music, for no longer will any student take the time to become a good artist. If he can't sing the first three lessons and do opera by the fifth, he changes teachers. He just will not do what the great singers did, and that is do scales for 5 years before they even sang one song. They won't do this anymore. They haven't time. Everything is in a hurry. Haste and tension go together. The tense person in singing becomes locked. The diaphragm is locked. The throat squeezes. Every part of the system is tied up in a tangle. So the singer, finding themselves blocked, comes to the conclusion that the only answer is to force through. So the voice comes out like a bellow. There is no tone, there is no quality, there is just a deadly struggle between the voice and the throat. This is due completely to the inability of the person to relax. They therefore turn in a miserable performance, are broken-hearted, and very often quite sick as a result of this struggle. If they had relaxed, if they had done the best they could and known that it wasn't going to be perfect, if they had even gone so far as to assume that their teacher was a kindly person, but the teacher knew their problem, therefore they didn't have to play games with the teacher. The same in life. If people would only assume that the world is more or less basically kindly, and it is very kindly to beginners if these beginners are cheerful and kindly themselves, so that there's no real need to have this terrible struggle in life. All these different forms of tension can be overcome by a little bit of the real Zen attitude. Zen takes the attitude that the thing done perfectly is the thing that is done with no interference from the person. Down inside of us, there is an autonomic structure, a process of subconscious directives. These subconscious directives, once they know what is expected of them, have an astonishing skill in fulfilling what is needed. Most inefficiency is due to the mind interfering with the natural instincts and impulses of the person. We could solve a great many problems better than we do if we would just stop thinking about them. The thinking is what gets us into trouble. It's the same with a pianist working on his instrument. He will never play well until he completely eliminates his hands. His hands simply cease to exist at a certain point in his practicing. Mental impulse is interpreted without any conscious effort, far more rapidly than the mind could possibly convey it, as far as a conscious process is concerned. He cannot play as long as his mind has to tell his fingers what note to hit. But when this becomes subconscious, the fingers hit the right note. In Japan, there is this old temple, the Sanju Sangendo in Kyoto, which was originally an archery field. along the eaved wall of this temple, which is 400 feet in length, was the ancient archery range that was used by the samurai and the great and skillful archers of Japan for annual competition. This competition was a very difficult thing because the eaves were very overhanging. The platform was comparatively low upon which the foundation of the building stood, so that the archer firing his 400-foot for his 400-foot target could not arch his arrow up. It would stick in the eaves. He had to shoot 400 feet almost on a straight line. And according to the competition, he had to shoot very rapidly with a very large bow. And to make it still more complicated, the Japanese archer usually shoots his bow sitting down. Now, this is enough to cause a lot of trouble on a 400-foot target. Yet the winner of one of these contests fired 11,000 arrows in 24 hours, of which 9,000 hit the target. This would be more than we could even accomplish. It would be incredible to our thinking. Now, the only way in which he could do that was that he was an archery master. The only way he could be a master was to study with an archery master who was Zen. It was the only way it could possibly be done. And this master would finally teach him that perfect archery was a complete relaxation of the whole nature. And several who have studied with these masters report that occasionally they got an arrow right. Now, of course, only in target practice. One of them explained it very simply. He said, after shooting badly, many, many arrows, he said, something suddenly happened as the result of long practice. I drew the arrow from the quiver. I put it to the bow. I raised the bow as though in a trance. There was absolutely no effort. I couldn't even know that my hand was pulling the string. And because there was no effort of any kind to pull the string much further than I ever had in my life. Everything was done as though in a trance. All of a sudden, let go of the arrow. A long, difficult shot and a complete bullseye. Couldn't do it again. It was months before the shot could be repeated. For once, the person had done it right. Had suddenly discovered that this very difficult bow draw, for it's a very powerful bow, and a very long shot, required no energy at all. The individual didn't know he had actually drawn the bow as far as energy was concerned. For the first time he had drawn the arrow to the head. When he was thinking about it, he couldn't begin to do this. Something happened. Everything fitted together to form the perfect shot. And then this carries on into other and all activities of life. The individual can reach a point in which whatever his problem may be, whatever his needs may be, whatever his responsibilities may be, they can be handled with effortless certainty. They can be handled without any anxiety or worry. If this man in this particular shot had said, I hope I will hit the bullseye, he never would have. If he had feared he would not hit the bullseye, he never would have. If he was nervous because he didn't want to make a shot that was bad before his teacher, he would never have hit the bullseye. If he had known perhaps another man was watching him, waiting to try to outdo him, he would never have hit the bullseye. But in those moments, he knew none of these things, although they might all have been occurring. There was only the perfect integration of himself. Now, Western people have no idea what this means. They try to say that it is negative, but that archer shot was not negative. They try to say that it represents a loss of all the progress we have made. It really doesn't at all. What it really stands for is the survival of the individual in the midst of his own progress. If he doesn't survive, what does progress mean? Progress cannot always be fighting ourselves, struggling against the weaknesses of our own lives. It can never be a continuation to eternity of our fears and doubts about providence, about the future, about war and peace. There has to be something more important than this. And if more people would try to understand some of these principles, life would be a lot easier for most people. So try this concept of the Zen archery principle in handling the day's work. One thing you can do in thinking through this a little is to look back over your own life somewhat and realize that there have been days when you have handled your problems pretty well. What was peculiar about those days? Why were they better than other days? Well, you say to yourself, perhaps I got up feeling a little better that morning. More optimistic. Something went a little better. Or I had some good news that made it easier. But whatever it is, try to find out what it was that made some days bright and other days not bright when life conditions were just about the same. And I think we'll find, as we do a little research, largely our own attitudes. We got up one morning, we got a little irritated when we got up. Some small problem got us started off the wrong way. From that time, the whole day was no good. Another day, we sort of got up a little bit better. The day was better. So if we find the morning starting with what looks to be a negative problem, then we've got to stop that problem right then and there before it has a chance to wreck the day. This business of going on and soaking in this problem is of no value to anyone. We have to conserve our energy, we have to integrate as much as we can, and we have to try to use the most constructive attitudes that we possess to direct us throughout every day of living. The best government is when the wisest rules all men. The best government in ourselves is when the wisest part of ourselves is in authority. And the wisest part of ourselves is very often a very simple part. The gentle part, the kindly part, the relaxed part. In this same problem of trying to find some type of detached tranquility in which to work, Zen goes into other areas of thinking also. Zen is always close to the idea of the hobby. The hobby or the avocation is a great help because it breaks the continuity of thought. And when we break a negative chain of thought, we have weakened it. And wherever we can break a negative chain, by doing something else, we should do so. The person who is mentally, emotionally inclined to be very sick is nearly always an individual who has no hobbies, no outlets, no avocational interests, no contrasts. They are living along one pattern exclusively. Now, another thing that Zen warns us about is this deadly seriousness of life. Zen is a religion. It is also a philosophy. And no one can deny that Zen is serious business. Yet Zen is forever warning the individual against the seriousness of his own thinking. Zen is forever telling him that seriousness can kill him without accomplishing any good whatsoever. Let us consider for a moment the seriousness of some people who have come to the conclusion that the good life must be a painfully thoughtful existence all the time. These individuals become afraid that anything that is not serious will be used against them in the cosmos. Such is not the case at all. Zen art is forever reminding us of the vanity of this serious, dignified attitude. The Zen monk has a dignity about him, but it is utterly uncultivated. He is never trying to be dignified. What he is striving for most of all is to be free from himself, to be free entirely from any measure of his own attitude, so that we mustn't forget that one of our troubles in modern Western living is the fact that we take things with great seriousness, when actually most of the things we are most concerned about have very little substance to them. Let the Zen with his koan, therefore, take some situation as, what about the man who is deadly afraid that unless he is serious, he is going to hazard his own salvation? That the only way he can hope to ultimately become all wise and all good is to dispose of all triviality and settle down to the murderous process of self-improvement. Zen has the perfect answer for this, namely that the perfect individual, by perfection, having entered the Mahaparinirvana, does not know whether he is perfect or not, and nobody cares. Perfection is not what he is seeking for, because Zen does not believe in perfect people. Zen does not believe that the individual can make salvation a job. He doesn't think of life in that way at all. He is not hoping for heaven. He is not trying to evade hell. These things are only terms which he believes some people use to frighten themselves with. To Zen, the victory is not this desperate seriousness. The victory is the simple process of being able to sit down in the garden and be one with life. To be one with things that man has nothing to do with, primarily. And in order to do this, the individual must get over within himself the things which he has had to do with, and become one again with a kind of a universal pattern of things. This universal pattern answers a lot of questions. It answers them in such a large, deep way that you can't entirely evade the consequences. The old Zen monk, for instance, sitting quietly by the side of his little waterfall, watching the fish jump in the pool, he says to himself, "Today I am here. But tomorrow the stone is empty. Where am I?" And he will say, "Well, probably, if I am not here, I won't know where I am. And where I am isn't going to be very important. If I have disappeared from this sphere of life, I have also left behind all the things that have to do with this sphere of life. But if there's any memory that I want to take out of this world, perhaps the most beautiful memory would be the waterfall, the very gentle afternoon sun and bringing out the morning glories, or bringing out all the wonderful flowers that you see. What else is there? My relatives? They're not really relatives. They're souls like I am, here, gone, no one knows where. Business? Don't worry about it. There will always be someone who will want to take it. And who will also come in the end to sit in a garden and figure out how to get rid of it. And being a kindly, good-natured man, this man will leave it to his sons after he has found it was unendurable for himself, and will consider that he is doing them a favor. These things happen. There are wars, bombs. terrible things devastate the universe. But there is either the garden, the old monk sitting there, no garden, no monk, all gone. For what? All the more reason why this strange, fantastic agitation over things that don't mean anything is a total waste of time. There are only certain things that man can do. He can give happiness and bring smiles to other people if he can. These are nice, pleasant ways to live. He can write good poems. He can paint a picture. He can sing a song. He can make a garden. He can tell stories to his grandchildren. He can bring up his family as well as he can. He can add his prayers to those at the altar of the temple. Give a few coins to rebuild the temple when this one is gone, and go to sleep in the little cemetery behind. These things are very simple. If we let them be simple, we can have a quiet, rather childlike existence. We can enjoy things. We can read good books. We can have friends. We will have no envious neighbors. If something comes along and these things are no longer possible, we'll adjust to what does come without fear, without anxiety, without misgiving, because we live in a universal law. The law works. There's no need to worry about these things, because anything that is worth worrying about belongs to a plan so lawful that no worry is necessary. All these are attitudes of fears and hatreds and all this. They're simply moods of our own ignorance, habits that we have allowed to take hold of us, habits by which we hurt and injure and destroy ourselves, habits by which we waste energy, which could be used to paint a beautiful picture, habits that shorten life and burden us with sickness. Habits that make us lonely old ages, because those around us do not want to endure these difficulties any longer. Everything is actually very simple until we make it complicated. So for people who are under tension and stress and things of that nature, they may as well face it. They're going to be under stress until they relax, until they are able to see through all of these weird patterns which are the cause of their stress. This great demand for things that we can't afford, keeping up with this and trying to get that. This desperate desire for something only to awaken after we have it and find that it's not very desirable after all, and we have to desire something else. All experiences we should learn. Experiences that should tell us that there is no place in a good life for bad thoughts. And thoughts either are creative and constructive and optimistic and friendly and charitable, or else they're no good. Nature has ways of paying, making us pay for our mistakes. And from the beginning of recorded history, nature has penalized the destructive thinker. We suspect this. But like the alcoholic, we do not know how to break the habit. We find we have learned to depend so much upon false thinking and feeling to give reason for life that we forget the fact that these things have only given reason for a bad life. They have never really justified a good life. Now, when we try to break the alcohol habit, by Alcoholics Anonymous or something of that time, we have a little fight on our hands. And I talked to an alcoholic not long ago who made it. And he said, well, there's something like this. I lost my job. I lost my home. I lost my car. I lost all my friends. I lost the respect of my children. I lost my job. I was headed for Skid Row. There was nothing more to lose. And I suddenly said to myself, how much more stupid can you get? How much more do you want to try to lose? When all that is necessary is to decide quietly in yourself that you've lost enough and that you are not going to allow a bottle to destroy you. And when I decided, I quit. There was no more problem. But he said, I had to reach a point where there was nothing more I could lose. I had to reach an absolute desperation. And then I discovered that I could have quit the first place if I wanted to. But I never wanted to as long as I could drink and still have enough to get by on. But this is the same thing that happens to a great many other people. While we can hold a home together or have the partial respect of our friends, we don't want to change our ways. We want to keep right on lines of least resistance. So in the bad disposition, or the energy-destroying forces of wrong attitude, wrong thought and emotion, we're in the same problem. We usually have to wait and we have a mental breakdown or a complete nervous breakdown. Or until we completely destroy our homes or lose our business or get into a hopeless mess before we decide in ourselves that it's time to do something different. And very often then we are so befuddled that we only blame other people and go on until it is hopeless. But at any moment we can change these patterns. And I cannot too strongly recommend that every individual who has a destructive habit pattern, which is using up energy, should say to himself, energy is much more than money in the bank. Energy is not only life, but it is the denominator of the kind of life that I'm going to live. If I abuse energy, I'm going to live, if I live at all, miserably. I'm going to have less and less joy, less and less production, less and less of everything valuable to the degree that I allow wrong intensities to govern me. They won't kill me like a bullet. They will cause a slow death, a death in which everything that is good dies first. And perhaps the individual lingers on, friendless and alone, because they have alienated everyone. The habit must be broken. And Western man is wrong in assuming that these habits are right. Man is wrong in assuming that he must be selfish. He is wrong in assuming that he has the right to make other people miserable. He is wrong in assuming that he must avenge himself for all real or imaginary injuries. He has finally to come to the simple realization that every destructive attitude that he holds is as poison to him as deadly nightshade, and that it will ultimately destroy his life and his happiness. If he will finally straighten these things out, he will see how much more energy he has. Tests have shown that it takes several times the energy to scowl that it takes to smile. And have you noticed that most sleeping people smile? Our natural tendency is to smile. The contented baby smiles. Old people, in the quiet evening of life, have a kind of smile on their faces. And many, many times, the dead smile. Smiling seems to be quite natural. And it takes a lot of energy to get a grumpy look. You really have to cultivate it. And you don't like the looks of it when you do, when you frighten children. Actually, the simple, childlike quality of expecting good, looking for good, believing in good, and returning good for anything that happens to you is the most powerful defense mechanism that we have. It is the one attitude which makes life best for us and those around us. The only people who will be offended by our happiness are the ones who want to make us unhappy. And the only way we can really evade them and bring them to justice is to simply not be unhappy. That will make them miserable. But they have no right to try to make us miserable. Relaxation is no energy wasted brooding or mooding on anything. Oh, this is so very good. Well, we have people come in to us quite frequently with many problems of one kind or another. We had one in for a while years ago at about a 15-year record for self-destruction. This individual had gone through an unpleasant emotional experience. They had lost their home, according to their point of view at least, through the horrible scheming of another person. Having gone through this experience, which subjectively I suspect they richly deserved, because they were born home spoilers themselves, this individual settled down to 15 years of self-pity. All the trimmings were present. One was extravagance. Having secured a fairly substantial alimony, the person attempted to get out of their difficulty by spending money. They also then discovered that by spending enough money, they could have a lot of hangers-on who despised them but would still hang around to get their share of the small change. This went on for years. There was never at any time any constructive effort to cope with this situation, and after a length of several years, alcoholism set in. The individual decided to try to drink themselves to death, all the time blaming this other person for all of this misfortune, blaming the other person for the fact that the one who was or believed themselves to be aggrieved, had no strength of character to meet a problem with. It went on and on and on until the person became mentally ill. And as most of these stories begin with self-pity, this one also ended in a mental institution. This person was not really in a bad way. They were talented, but they wouldn't use their talents. They had some fair attractiveness, but they refused to be attractive. They had very good education, but they would make no use of it. The only thing they could do was to brood upon the fact that they had lost somebody's affection. Well, it's too bad. But it certainly is no excuse for going into a complete rot as a result. I talked to this person on a number of occasions. They admitted they were wrong, but they couldn't do anything about it. They felt like falling to pieces, so they fell apart. This has been Western man's solution to his problem for ages. It's just keep on doing whatever he felt like doing. We felt like conquering the world. We had a Caesar, an Alexander, a Napoleon, or a Hitler. These people did as they pleased, regardless of who it hurt or how much. And we have assumed that this is the only way to get along in this world. And as long as we have this attitude, I'm afraid internationally and nationally, we're going to be in serious trouble. This is not the answer. The answer that every individual must face is the answer of making out of himself a powerful, constructive force for the leadership of his own life. But we cannot keep on going as we are now without ultimately deteriorating to a dangerous degree. We have to take hold of these situations. Zen begins with self-discipline. Zen takes the attitude that there is never one moment in the life of the individual when he is not in control of himself if he wants to be. There is never one time in an individual's life when he cannot help self-pity. There is never one moment in his existence while he has to be selfish. There is not one moment when he has to be envious, or has to hate, or has to gossip. These are not necessary things. They are simply weaknesses. The individual who cannot get over gossiping may just as well admit that he has an incurable habit, the same as the alcoholic has one. And like the alcoholic, there's never a moment when he can't get over it. But he doesn't know it, or won't believe it, or won't try. If we are going to use what energies we have to unfold our lives and our world, we've got to begin to build these patterns of usage by which energy is directed constantly toward the end which we really want to attain. One way I think that would always help everyone in connection with these problems is to set aside a few minutes every day for a meeting with the steering committee. And that steering committee is yourself. You have over 40 faculties within you, which bring in various testimonies, mostly conflicting, like the members of a hopeless board of directors. I believe it was Albert Hubbard that said on one occasion, a board of directors is a group of people that takes 10 times as long to accomplish anything as one person would take to do it alone. But that's one of our problems. We have all these faculties within our own natures. Each of these faculties has its voice. We must have a Senate. We must have a House of Representatives or a cabinet or a government. But we must settle down once, maybe every day, for a few minutes to take care of some pressing legislations that are in great need of being accomplished. Every day, we have a right to sit down and quietly survey ourselves. Find out what, at the moment, is giving us trouble. When we think of other people, always bear in mind that it is not other people that are causing trouble. It is our inability to cope with other people that causes trouble. If we are having difficulty with someone, what is the attitude that would cure that difficulty? Now, we don't think of compromise. We don't think of the individual agreeing with someone who is wrong. What is the correct attitude with which to meet the challenge, perhaps of a basic misunderstanding? Think it through. Quietly, peacefully, and with relaxation of mind and emotions, examine the facts. The moment you become fact conscious, most of your problems will dissolve. Emotion and thought are fact destroyers. It's strange to think of thoughts as destroyers of truths, but they are. Our thoughts become merely eye servants of our own opinions. What we call a thought is nothing but an opinion used to defend some attitude of our own. Get away from this. There is a simple answer to everything. Find it. There is a simple, natural, dignified, immediate way of solving problems. Seek that way. And dedicate every phase of life to solution of complication. Start no new project while old ones are unfinished. Do not try to avoid one situation by creating another to confuse it further. Solve the one. And always solve without hatred, without prejudice, without unhappiness. Always find that solution must bring with it complete peace. Nothing is solved unless it ends in a deep, happy feeling in yourself. A feeling of victory. A feeling that it is right. A feeling that something that is wrong has been taken away. A person who has been in poor health and is gradually recovering from an ailment may awaken one morning and suddenly, for the first time in months, feel alive. Suddenly he knows that he has had a victory over the ailment. He knows that in a mysterious way, health has reaffirmed itself in him. And there is a kind of strange feeling of well-being that accompanies this experience, this discovery. With solution, there is also this wonderful sense of well-being. There is the feeling that now this mystery is solved forever, that it will never arise again, that there can never be any mistakes of this kind repeated. And the only time when we can say that is when we have solved the thing in ourselves. Having this quiet peacefulness, we discover that we can do so much more. The hours that were spent struggling with these problems are now available for learning, for art, for music, for travel, for growth, for the development of the abilities of the individual. And if we can rescue one half an hour from grudges and dedicate that half hour to growth, we will find that in 6 months, great changes will take place in our lives and attitudes. We have to make the step, however. And the one thing that Zen can tell us to help us to make the step is that what we are really worrying about is a dream. This step is not arming against an adversary. There isn't any adversary. This bad habit that we have been suffering with and struggling against for years is nothing but a form of self-hypnosis. It is an obsession that we have permitted to grow. It is a strange illusion from which we can awaken at any moment we want to. We have fashioned it. It has no life but the life of energy which we turn into it from our own supply. Turn off that energy. No longer energize negation and it dies. And the energy which we have wasted on it is now available for progress. You cannot hate without energy. You cannot fear without energy. Cut off the energy. Refuse to allow negative things to be energized. When they arise, block them completely from your mind. When they try to insinuate themselves into your thinking, quietly deny them that right. Do not fight them, simply refuse to accept them. Put in their place positive and constructive attitudes and things that need the doing. Now, this isn't a struggle that'll take the rest of your life. Take an attitude that is troublesome to you and approach it systematically. Reduce the energy equivalent. Refuse to allow anything to add to that problem. Refuse to interpret any more trouble into that problem. Refuse to energize it by thinking or feeling about it. and in 3 months the problem will die. If you will really do this, you don't have to fight it the rest of your life. Once you know your master, once you realize that this problem is only a fraud in your own thinking, you can conquer it. Because it has nothing in the form of magnitude or strength or size to prevent it from being conquered. This terrible thing is only a nightmare which is removed by the mere process of waking up. So against all negative attitudes, follow the Zen concept of just wake up. Wake up to this garden world with the pool, the stone lantern. Wake up to a strange world that is so full of gracious and beautiful things that there is no time, no energy, no need to waste one single moment in the contemplation of negation or destruction. If you will work with this problem, I think you will find that you will feel better, will solve problems, and have much more life and vitality with which to carry on new and better interests that you might like to develop. Well, I guess our time is up, so we thank you for being with us this evening.